This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We have to start at 7:15. We're already getting earlier. So from next Motzei Shabbos in session, we'll start it at 7:15. I had actually hoped to give a final share of the last series tonight, and what happened was as follows. Over a number of weeks I'd prepared the share, but the basic things that I'd prepared were the sources on which I was going to work, and throughout my study I'd left slips of paper in each sefer on the particular page where I needed the makor. It being this time of the year, it was decided that the time had come round to clean the svarim for Pesach, and this was very thoroughly done. And in fact, when I came back, every sefer was in its place except it was upside down. And thanks to Michael King, that's no longer the case. They're not upside down. But then the maid said to me, "Please don't worry about all those little papers you left in the svarim. I put them all neatly together in your top left-hand drawer." So it's going to take me a few more weeks to put it together again. So this shiur is nevertheless a continuation of last week's shiur in a sense, but on one particular topic which we touched on last week, and which we'll take a little bit more thoroughly this week and possibly in future weeks. There's a Mishnah in the beginning of the fifth parak of Brochus which says, "Ein oimdin lihispalel elo mitoich koved rosh." One only stands to daven, one only gets up to daven, provided one is davening mitoich kovid rosh. There has to be seriousness of intention, there has to be a serious mind. Chasidim harishonim, the early chasidim, hoyushoyin shor achas mispalelim. They used to wait a full hour before they even used to start davening. Ask the Gemara, minani mili, where do we learn this from? And the Gemara goes through various psukim which it suggests as sources for this din that one's davening has to be with kovid rosh. Why does the Gemara need sources for it? Isn't it obvious? It seems not. It seems that there's a havamina that one's davening should be in with great levity and rejoicing. Amar Rabbi Loza, Amar Kro. The one pasuk that Rabbi Loza brings is vehi maras nefesh. When Chana davened for a child, she was very bitter. So we see that there's got to be also a degree of seriousness, a degree of heaviness, a degree of bitterness as well. Also the Gemara, no, Mimaidu Mechana Shani, Chana might be an exception. She was very sad, she was davening at a very sad stage of her life. How can you bring a proof from her that that's how one is meant to be, that one is meant to be sad when one doesn't? Elo Amar Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina Mihacha. That says Rabbi Yossi Rabbi Chanina from here. Va'ani Berov Chazdecho Ovri Beisecho Eshtacha Ve'elhecho Kudshecho Be'irosecho. And I, in your great kindness, will come to your house, and I shall bow down in your holy abode, beyirosecho, in fear of you. Maybe this is, you're bringing proofs from King David. It's different. And the tzar nafshe brach mituve, he used to be mispalel, he used to daven a lot. It's not for everybody. Elam Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi mehochlos. Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi suggested from here, hishtachavu l'Hashem bahadras kodesh. Bow down to Hashem Bahadras Kodesh, which means in the glory of holiness. Al tikri Bahadras, don't read it literally Bahadras, Elo Bechardas, that was trembling. So the Gemara, who says Hadras Mamish? Maybe it really means in glory. Why change the meaning? Kihod Rav Yehuda, as we know with Rav Yehuda, was in fact the case, have a Mitzayin Natshev, Hoda Matzli. Before he used to go and daven, he used to dress up in the fanciest, most chosh of clothes that he could. He was mitzayin nafshe. Elo amar Rav Nachman ba Yitzchak mehocha. But said Rav Nachman ba Yitzchak from here, ivdu es Hashem beyiro vegilu biro odo. Serve Hashem in fear and rejoice before him in trembling. And it's the last part of the posuk that I want to discuss. Ask the Gemara, mai vegilu biro odo, what does it mean, and rejoice before him in trembling? In the very place of rejoicing, even though tefillah is a form of rejoicing and praising of Ribbono Shel Olam, Sham Tehei Ra'odo, at that very same place, there's got to also be fear, there's got to also be trembling. And what we're going to look at tonight is this combination of very contrasted and conflicting emotions. It is terribly difficult to express rejoicing when one is self-conscious. If one feels relaxed, completely relaxed, and one feels uninhibited, and one is not being watched, and one feels really, one can unwind, then there can be a degree of rejoicing. But it's very difficult to be rejoicing and the Sunday Times is sitting there with their cameras ready. What kind of rejoicing can you do? And to be rejoicing and you know that every move you make is being watched. And to be rejoicing and you know that if you make a wrong move, somebody is going to start screaming at you or something. You can't have a good time like that. Ra'odo, trembling, is tremendous self-consciousness. To be in a state of fear is one of the most inward things there is. To be afraid, to be worried about what is going to happen to me or what might happen to me. There is nothing more inward, there's nothing more self-conscious than fear. And we're told that Gilu Lefonov Bira'oda, rejoice before the Ribbono Shel Olam in trembling. How do you do it? How is it possible? To rejoice before the Ribbono Shel Olam is difficult enough. But to do it in trembling, these seem such different emotions, they seem such opposite emotions, that it would appear on the surface impossible to reconcile them to. And all that shows is that we're missing some understanding of the Gilu and some understanding of the Ra'oda. The Rambam paskens in the beginning of the second parak of Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, Hokel Hanichbad V'Hanoira Hazeh, this honored and wonderful God, Mitzvah Le'ahavoi U'Liyiroi, it is a mitzvah to love him and to fear him. Also conflicting emotions when you think about it. To love somebody and to fear them. I had the opportunity to be mekayim the mitzvah this morning of giving my little daughter a hiding. So afterwards, when her mother was comforting her, I said to the child, "Do you love your father?" She said, "No." I said, "It doesn't matter, you don't have to." I said, "Are you scared of him?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Good." I said, "Do you love your mother?" She said, "Yes." I said, "Are you scared of her?" She said, "No." That's how it's supposed to be. That I can understand. To love one and to be scared of the other. But to love and be scared of the same one? How can that be possible? How does one bring those two emotions into a situation where they can be parallel without disturbing one another? Where you can be relaxed in a love of fear and in a fear of love. What is it exactly? Shneimar, as it says, Ve'ahavtus Hashem Elokecha, you shall love the Lord your God. Ve'neimar, as it says, Hashem Elokecha Tiro, you shall fear the Lord your God. And Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, there's only one God. So it's that very same Ribbono Shel Olam to whom we have to relate simultaneously with love and fear. So the Peirush on the Rambam says that before we even come onto Ahavas Hashem, Yesh Lanu Ma'alo Hi Kodemes L'Ma'ala Zu. There is a level which comes before the level of the love of Hashem. V'yibachuso mimeno, and it's lower than it. It's less worthy than it. V'hi ma'alat hayiro, and this is the achievement of yiro, of fear of Hashem. V'gam hi mecheleches l'shnei chalokim, and this too is divided into two sections. Yiro, fear of Hashem, has two aspects to it. Ha'achas, the one is hi yiras amei ha'oretz. The one is the yira of Amoratsim, ignoramuses, women. The parish obviously didn't know the women of Ketatar. Anoshim, women, v'ktanei haseichel, and people of limited intellect. Sheyiru Hashem, where they fear Hashem, v'yavdu oisoi. Or should I say, perhaps the parish didn't know the men of the 1980s. That we're all the Tzotzis and Anoshim, we're all in the same, because this is our Yira. Where we fear Hashem, alavai this was our Yira, if only this was our Yira. where we fear Hashem, v'yavdu oisoi, and they serve Him, that means that they do all the mitzvahs and they do no averus. Look what level he's talking about. This is for the Amaratzim and the Ketanei Asechel and the Noshim. That's just the ordinary people. Shema yamisoisam. But what's motivating them? They're afraid that if they don't, Hashem might kill them. Or yarig b'neihem chas v'sholim, might kill their sons. Or yichasre momen, or he'll cut down their incomes. Or shilo yanchil in Gan Eden, or they won't get Gan Eden. This he calls the Ketanei Asechel, a person who keeps the entire Torah for fear that if he doesn't, he may lose his Olam Haba. That's the bottom level for people of limited intellect. That's the lower level of Yiro. Yiro, he says, comes before Ahava. You know, we all think that we're already operating on the level of loving God. We all love God. We're nowhere near there. Before loving God comes Yiro, and Yiro is divided into two sections. The lower section for the Ketanei Asechel is where you keep the entire Torah and you serve the Ribono Shel, but why do you do it? Because you're afraid of losing your Olam Haba. That's why you do it. Or you're afraid of being punished somehow in this world. V'achelik Hasheni, and the second one, hi ha-yiro ha-amitis. That's the true yiro. V'hu k'shi yizboinen b'maaseh ha-kel, and that is when a person thinks about the actions of the Ribbono Shel, the Yasig Mehem Godloi, and he understands their greatness, the Yeda Shehu Ber Yoshefelo, and he appreciates that he's an insignificant creature. Kishiyaruch Nafshu Echod Min Agufim Anichbodim, when he compares himself to one of these upper greater beings, etc., and he realizes how the distance between him and the Ribbono Shel. So there's Yiras Ha'oinish and Yiras Ha'roinimus. Fear of punishment and fear of the Ribbono Shel Olam's greatness. Two different kinds of Yiro. You can have the kind of Yiro that in the presence of a policeman one behaves a little bit better than when the policeman isn't there. And in the presence of an Olam Choshuv one behaves better than when he isn't there. But two completely different things. With the policeman you behave a little bit better because you're afraid that he might see you and he might fine you for what you're doing. With an Olam Choshuv it's a different kind of thing. There's just an atmosphere which requires you, out of respect to him, to behave better. So Yiras Ha'oinish with Yiras Ha'roinimus. Now in this week's Sedra we have the tragedy of Nodav v'Avihu, the two sons of Aaron. Who bring in a fire into the Mishkan for the Korban HaKetores in a way that they were not instructed, and they die immediately. Vayomer Moshe el Aaron, and Moshe says to Aaron, who is now distraught, his two sons are wiped out while serving in the Beis HaMikdash. Hu asher diber Hashem leimor, that's exactly what Hashem meant when he said, Bekorovai ekodesh, through those who are close to me, I will become holy. And on the faces of all the people I shall become honored. By Yidem Aaron, and then Aaron was silenced. He accepted it. What does it mean? So Rashi says, and most of the Mefoshim learn the same way, when the Ribbono Shel Olam punishes a tzaddik, misyarei umita. The Ribbono Shel Olam becomes feared and becomes elevated and praised. Im kein be'elu kol shchein b'rashoy, people say to themselves, if such tzaddikim are judged so severely, how much more so the wicked people? And that's in the interest of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's how Rashi learns it. So when it says, listen to the pasuk clearly, because we're going to develop it, bekorovai ekodesh ve'al pnei chol ha'om ekoved, I will become sanctified with my those who are close to me, and on the face of all the people I shall be honored. Explains Rashi, by killing my close ones I become honored on the faces of the masses. Everybody appreciates God more when they see the level of justice that he meets out, even to the tzaddikim, even to the righteous people, how much more so to the ordinary people. And the justice of God becomes something very clear and very prominent. So very nice. God is imposing his fear on Bnei Israel. How does he do it? By killing Nodav v'Avihu. No, there are no other ways of doing it. Is that all he can do to get the people to really appreciate who he is? He has to kill somebody? And look who? Nadav Abir. There was another case involving fire, but it ended in a different way. The Medrash says in Vayakel, Toiv Shem Mishemen Toiv. It quotes the Pasuk in Koheles, a good name is worth more than good oil. And the Medrash says, Toiv Hoyo Shemoisom Shel Chananya Mishor Vazariya Mishemen Amishcho Shinim Shehu Nodo Vavir. What does it mean? Chananya, Mishael, and Azariah had no official status. They were three tzaddikim. They weren't even Nevi'im. Three tzaddikim. And they were thrown into a furnace of fire by Nebuchadnezzar, as you know, and they came out unscathed. Whereas not the Vavi who are Kohanim, who have been anointed with oil, that's the Shemen Tov. They don't even touch fire, they just go in with the Ketoret into the Beit HaMikdash, and the fire consumes them, the fire destroys them. As a Medrash, you're better off with a good name than with a good job, with a good position. That's what the Medrash means. The Shemen Tov, the Shemen HaMishcho, they had status, they were Kohanim. That couldn't protect them from the fire. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, what did they have? They had a good name. That could protect them from the fire. Tov, Shem, Shemen Tov. In Tanakh, in Daniel, we see the effect that miracle had on Nebuchadnezzar. Nebuchadnezzar was a Rosh Merusha, he was the wicked of the wickedest, Nebuchadnezzar. And when he saw that, Nebuchadnezzar said Baruch Hashem, he started praising the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the Gemara tells us that it was ad kedei kach, it was so much so, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, that at that moment Nebuchadnezzar started composing psalms, he started composing Tehillim. And that were it not that an angel came and stopped him, and that he was diverted, that his own confusion actually diverted him from that, he would have created a book of psalms greater, says the Gemara, than the Tehillim of David HaMelech. Look what a level, a Rosh HaMerusha, the bottom of the barrel, can achieve heights that exceed those in spiritual awareness and spiritual expressiveness, higher than David HaMelech in one moment. And what caused it? Seeing Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah walk into the fire and come out alive. That did it. So the Ribbono Shel Olam knows how to impress people. He knows how to get people to understand that Ein Oid Milvado, there's nothing else than the Ribbono Shel Olam, without killing. Surely that's the way to do it. Surely he could have impressed the nation by showing his power that way, rather than by killing Nadav Abihu. And furthermore, there's a strange instruction given to the family. And Moshe said to Aaron and to Elozer and Itamar, his remaining two sons, don't exercise the customs of mourning. Don't tear your clothes and so on, and you won't die. And if you do that, then the whole Hashem will get angry on the whole community. The rest of Klal Yisrael will mourn. It's not for you to mourn. So we won't get into the whole reason with a coin in the middle of his avodah and so on. But why does the whole of Klal Yisrael have to mourn? Okay, they've lost two sons of Aaron. But still, that there's a mitzvah, that there's a chiyuv on the whole of Klal Yisrael to do the mourning, which really Aaron and his brother and his son should have done. It seems that Klal Yisrael had some part in the death. The Ibn Ezra says something which is slightly different to Rashi. And when I will show them my kedusha, my holiness, as ehye nichbad, then I will be honored. The alpnei kol ha'om achabed ve'yiru mimeni, and on the faces of all the people I will be honored, and they will fear me. What's he saying? Let's look at it carefully. And when I shall demonstrate to them my kedusha, my holiness, as then, I will be honored. Again, that means I'm going to be honored by killing Nadav va'Avihu. Va'apnei kol ha'am echabed, and on the faces of all the people I shall be honored. And then he adds a difficult thing. Ve'yiru mimeni, and they will be, have fear of me. What is the Ibn Ezra adding? He seems to be implying that if I don't kill Nadav va'Avihu, they may honor me, but they won't fear me. They won't be yiru. If I display my honor without killing Nadav va'Avihu, they won't be yiru. They won't be the Yerumimen. Maybe they'll be Akolo Amachabed, but not the Yerumimen. We did a little piece of Meshech Chochmah last night, and I want to do another little piece with you. Because in the way he puts it, also, I think one can see the Yesod which is hidden under the words of the Ibn Ezra. The Zeshe Omar. And this is what it means when it says, "Bikaroivai akadesh, I shall become sanctified through my close ones." The as, and then he also puts in the word the as. Only the Ibn Ezra does that, and here the Meshech Chochma seems to be using the same line, the as, and then as a consequence. It's not the same as Rashi. Rashi said simultaneously, "By killing Nadav va'Avihu, I shall become honored among the people." The Ibn Ezra said, "As, then I will be." And the Meshech Chochma also says, "V'zeh shoma b'krovai akadesh v'az, and then al p'nei kol ha'am achabed, ar'e kavodi li'Yisrael, I shall show my honor to Yisrael." What does that mean? Before I kill Nadav va'Avihu, I won't show my honor to Yisrael. So we see again in the Meshech Chochma, these are two different things. The killing of Nadav va'Avihu is a precondition for demonstrating his kavod to Yisrael, his honor to Yisrael, and that will take place at a later stage. Avaluza is there, and he says it now mefurish. He says it explicitly. But were it not for this, loy uchol laharis kavodi libnei Yisrael, I would be unable to show my honor to Bnei Yisrael. The man loy yidmu ki ben adam hu v'noisei pesha bli mishpat, so that they would not think that the Ribbono Shel'olam is a human being who can just forgive without justice. Chalilo melokei mishpat lo yaseh mishpat chas v'sholem, that a God of justice should not do justice. And then Aaron said, what do we have here? Unlike Rashi and the Das Keni Balei HaTosfos and Adam Mefoshim, the Meshech Chochma seems to be working, and the only Rishon that I can be told on is the Ibn Ezra, that there are really two things that the Ribbono Shel'olam is saying. Bikaroivai Akadesh, says Moshe to Aaron, rest assured Aaron, this has all got meaning to it. The Ribbono Shel'olam needed to do that in Nadav va'Avihu, because were it not for that, he would not be able to be Mekayim Va'al Pnei Chol Ha'am Ekoved. Now I can reveal my honor to all the people, now that I've done that. But says the Meshech Chochma, if it were not for that, I would not be able to show my honor to the people. I would have to withdraw my honor. I'm going to repeat a Yesod that I did with the ladies this morning, and I'm not even going to apologize to the ladies for two reasons. Firstly, the Yesod is difficult, and if they hear it a second time, it will only benefit them. And secondly, most of the ladies weren't even there this morning, so they'll only be hearing it for the first time. The other thing I mentioned in the ladies' shiur is that I know now why there's been a drought in South Africa. Because when there's rain, everybody stays at home, so the Ribbono Shel'olam had rachmonos practiced on the society. When there's rain, people don't come to shul, they don't come to shiurim, they all sit at home. So he didn't have rain, so that we would come to shul, that we would come to shiurim, that we would do what we have to do. If we would show the Ribbono Shel'olam that in the rain we can also go out, that we're not afraid of melting, that we can walk in the street in the rain as well, particularly in this day of age of modern raincoats, which I think Roy can supply for anybody who doesn't have one. There's no reason to stay at home. Then it's possible that the droughts will be broken. What is the difference between Yiras HaRoimimus and Yiras HaOinish? Fearing God's greatness and fearing punishment. And I gave two examples. The first example is that you go to the Durban Aquarium, except a bigger one than that, and you fill it up with lots of vicious sharks. And across the top of it you place a beam of wood which goes from one end to the other, and it's about 3 or 4 centimeters wide. And you say to a person, "Now, walk across it. If you fall in, sorry, you're dead. That's the end of you. These sharks have been starving for ages. They're waiting for you. If you get to the other side, then yeshikach, very good. And you start walking, step by step, carefully, from one end to the other. And the sweat is pouring down your face with every step that you take. And you stop and you look down and you see the sharks this side, and you see the sharks that side, and you walk further. That's yiro, that's fear. And you tremble, and you're shaking. And you come to the other side and you're white, and you're finished, and you collapse, and you want a glass of water, and then you just want to go to bed and sleep it all off. It's been a nightmare that you want to get over. And then if we take that same wooden beam and we say to you, look, there's this beautiful garden, it's the same length, and on each side of the wooden beam, right up to the wooden beam, there are the most beautiful flowers. However, you need to know that there's only one of each of these flowers left in the world, and this is it. All these flowers are the last specimens of their species. Now you have to walk from this side to the other side, and if you should fall off the beam, you're going to ruin these flowers, and that will never happen again. And you start, and you walk. But you look to the left and you look to the right, and there are no sharks that are waiting to eat you up. They're just beautiful flowers wherever you look. And you're filled with a feeling of appreciation and admiration for them. And instead of this tense, aggravated look on your face, there's a pleasant, relaxed smile on your face as you put one foot before the other and you balance your way forward. And the smile becomes broader and broader as you walk more and more. And as you get to the end, your face breaks out into laughter, and you're joyous, and you're ready to go and to bounce, and you're quite happy. You've done exactly the same thing. You've crossed exactly the same bar, exactly the same length, the same conditions. The only thing that has been different is the consequences of failure. But the action has been identical. Why are the symptoms so different? Why, when you come to the end of one, are you completely emotionally and physically drained? And when you come to the end of the other one, you're exalted and you're stimulated and you're ready for new challenges. What's the difference? The difference is that if you took a cat and you put the cat on the beam that goes over the shark infested aquarium or oceanarium, the cat would walk from one end to the other side without moving off the bar, and without much difficulty. But if you put the cat on the second beam, he wouldn't bother walking more than a few inches, if that, on the beam, and then he would walk all over the flowers. That's the difference. The one is the action of a human being, and the one is the action of an animal. To walk a tightrope successfully when the consequence is death, that any animal can do, it's instinctive. There's no spiritual level to achieve that. You don't need to appreciate things. You're not doing anything for anybody else. It's pure self-centeredness. It's pure self-preservation. There's an inborn force that keeps every human being desiring to live, wanting to live, and with the reflex actions that make him live. With that we're born. We have reflex actions of self-preservation. But when the only consequence is that you might spoil a few flowers, there are no reflexes. For that you need a neshama. For that you need a soul. For that you need a mind. For that you need a sense of responsibility. For that you have to be a human being. And you see just by the way that one gets tired, aggravated, frustrated, destroyed, drained by behaving like an animal. One is elated and exalted and stimulated by behaving like a mensch. And some of you know, when a person feels drained, it's because it's all been self-centered. When one's been busy outwardly, yes, it's demanding, obviously it's demanding, but the feeling is very different, and it's a very good test always to know whether what one has been doing is an outward or an inward action. The first is Yirat HaOinish. That is the feeling of serving the Ribbono Shel Olam out of fear. Whether it is fear of punishment in this world or fear of punishment in the next world, it doesn't make any difference. If you believe in a world to come, there is no more real punishment to you than the loss of the world to come. So to go through life fearing the consequences with chas v'sholom, one wrong step and I stand to lose my parnosa, my income, my family chas v'sholom, my own life, my own olam haba, the worst of all. One goes through life like that. Life is a bind. It's heavy. Real, real heavy. That's Yiras HaOinish. Second one is Yiras HaRoimus. Also fear of the Ribbono Shel Olam, awe of the Ribbono Shel Olam. But I'm involved in him, not in me. I'm involved in giving him pleasure, not in saving the consequences of my own actions from my own selfish point of view. It's the same tension, but it's not the same aggravation and frustration. What happens if we take the yira away altogether? And we say, look, we would like you to walk down this beam from here to there. There are no flowers on the side, there's no sharks on the side, there's nothing on the side, just gravel. What's going to happen? You'll get bored after 6 steps. Like the cat. Absolutely bored and you'll give it up. Life without tension, one gives up. A person, poshut, loses the zest for life where there's no tension. Where you don't feel that a false step has consequence, there's no sense of achievement at all. There's no tension at all. And there's no life at all. It's amazing how false words can lead people to such false philosophies. They discover that tension is a cause of disease, particularly heart disease. Not Yishukach. That you needed minds to discover such a thing is also a bit of a chiddush. That any child in school wouldn't tell you that, I also don't know. They've just discovered tension. And so they go around with these words, tension. And we get this big feeling of wherever you see the word tension, you get the skull and crossbones. Cut out the tension and we're dead. We can't live without tension. And the fact is, what do people go to horror movies for? Why do people drive at high speeds? Why do people climb mountains and do all sorts of dangerous things if tension is so bad for people? We need it. And the more the tension is removed from our lives, the less the lives are meaningful. We don't need frustration. We don't need aggravation. That's something else. But you don't hear the doctors talking about that so much. You hear the word tension. Life is like a violin. No tension in the strings, the notes get flat. That's how it is. Of course, if there's abrasiveness in the strings, if there's frustration and aggravations in the strings, then they snap. But if there's no tension, there's no music. There's no tension in life, there's no music. Walk down that beam with no flowers on either side and with no sharks on either side and you won't even walk. You'll stop. Rather the sharks than nothing. At least if the sharks are there, there's tension. There's life. There's reality. There's consequence. So those are the two types. Yiras ha'oinesh v'yiras ha'roimimus. But we're still left with the old question. If God is going to choose a way of imposing His the fear of Him, the awareness of Him, the consciousness of Him on Klal Yisrael, can He choose no better way than killing Mother by view? Surely the method He used with Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah would be much greater. Surely to show His miracles in kindness would be greater than to show His miracles in wrath. But we see a chiddush in the Meshech Chochma and in the Ibn Ezra, that the Yiras Haroimimus, that second form of Yira, that second form of fear of God, cannot be achieved without going through the first one. Let's take a third example. Let's say, before the third example, we'll use first the second example again. So you're walking down, but now it's a competition, a whole lot of people. And you're first, and you're walking down the beam with the flowers on each side, and the emotions are as we discussed and described. And after you, another person does it, and it's the same thing. After you, a third person does it, and he falls off. And everybody's horrified, and it's a terrible thing. Okay, so he's finished. Then another one does it, and he also falls off. After that, what happens? It's finished. It's lost, the fear is gone. There's been a pritzas geder, the fear has been broken already. The fences have been broken down. It's not such a... No, they're destroyed in any case. A few more will be destroyed. As long as none of these flowers have been destroyed and each one was the last one and you were going to be the first to destroy them, then there was the tension. But once other people have already started the process of destruction, there's no tension left anymore. What happens if we add an element to the second example and we combine the two in a way and we say, right, you walk down this beam. If you fall off, you're going to destroy one of these flowers, or more than one, which is the last one of its kind. And in addition to that, you will have to pay 5,000 rand for each flower you destroy. And if you can't pay the money, you go to jail. Day for rand. Now what? So now it's a combination. Now you walk and it's not quite such a smile on your face. Now there's tension, real tension. And now you're walking with a frown on your face. It's a little bit more like walking over that shark infested oceanarium. But when you get to the end, what do you feel? Phew, I saved 5,000 rand, or I saved the flowers. Then it's I saved the flowers. The money, the fine, was only the consequence of not saving the flowers, but the main thing was saving the flowers. That's what was prime in your mind. But it added a little bit more excitement to it. Made it a little bit more real. Imagine a situation where you go into one of these casinos and you sit down at a table and you decide you're going to watch before you start playing. And you watch and you see everybody concentrating very carefully and you see the chips piling up. And you see a man making 100, 200, 500, 1,000, 2,000, stuffing it into his pockets. And then you see another man losing. 100, 200, 300, 500, 1,000, 2,000, losing, being cleaned out. You see him break into tears and crack up and disappear from the room. And then you see the one who was making the money before starting to lose the money. Now it's getting exciting. Now you start playing. Imagine if you're in that same casino and you see the same kind of thing happening, but first you notice he's making thousands and he's not terribly happy, and another guy has just lost 10,000 and he's not terribly worried. So you tap your friend on the shoulder and you say, I don't understand. Look how much you've just lost. He says, that one was only plastic chips. It's not, we're not playing for money. It's just a game. So you get up and you go. How boring. The game only has meaning if there are real consequences. If there are not real consequences, it doesn't have any meaning. Life is real only as much as we have to take responsibility for our actions. As long as there's a way out, as long as we don't have to take ultimate responsibility for our actions, it's playing roulette with plastic money, that's what it is. It's going into business where it's just a game, it's monopoly. That's the difference between monopoly and business. A child can play monopoly because he has imagination. If an adult plays monopoly, he's got to attach real money values to what he's playing. An adult plays in business. And then it's exciting because then it's real. I remember as a little child learning Chumash with my father for the first time, doing that parsha for the first time. We were doing the parsha of Yehuda and Tamar. The whole development of the parsha, and I find that Tamar is pregnant, and they come and ask the shayla, and it's decided, Hoitzio Lisoref, bring her out to be burnt. It's the end of her, she's done a terrible thing. And I stopped my father and I said to him, you know what's exciting about all this? He says, if it was fiction, I would know that she would get off in the end. They're not going to kill the hero. But with a Torah, you never know what's going to happen. She might actually die. As we see right through the Torah, Moshe and Aaron don't get to Eretz Yisrael for a tiny little Avera. They don't get to Eretz Yisrael. No tefillah, no tshuva, nothing helps. There's no way they don't get there. How much we've seen of the suffering of great people in the Torah. Imagine that Nebuchadnezzar watches Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah go into the fire, and he says to himself, I know how this is going to end. None of the close people to the Ribbon Shem have ever gotten burnt before. It's obvious how it's, obviously they're going to get out. And they get out. Is he going to make Tehillim greater than David HaMelech's Tehillim? Is he going to be moved to praising the Ribbono Shel Olam and declaring that there's none other than the Ribbono Shel Olam? Are the people of Nebuchadnezzar going to say, as they said, you Am Yisrael with a God like that, how can you bow down to an idol? It's not possible. How can you do such a thing? Would they react in that way if they expected Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah to walk out? No. Bikroivai akadesh dal pnei kol ha'am akarekoveh. Only if somebody has been burnt with fire can I later use fire as a way of performing a miracle. If nobody's ever suffered the consequences, it's not real, then it's play. People need to realize that the Keteres has within it the ability to kill, that the Keteres is powerful, that the Keteres could be destructive if it's handled incorrectly. People have to realize that there are times they cannot get around me. Says the Meshech Chochmah, this comes after the Egel Hazov. What happened with the Egel Hazov? They did a terrible thing. However we'll explain the Egel Hazov, the fact is, with the golden calf, they did a terrible thing. And God was angry. And he wanted to destroy them, absolutely to wipe them out, every one of them, except Moshe. He wanted to start again from Moshe Rabbeinu. And Moshe pleads with them and says, give another chance. And he goes down and Moshe works with them and they donate money to the Mishkan and they rebuild and they build a Mishkan now and they do tshuva, etc., etc., etc. They lost all their glory. The Anone covered, the clouds of glory disappeared. The all sorts of ornaments and things which they had, which were vestiges of Har Sinai, have gone and disappeared. We learned last night that they are not able to look Moshe in the face anymore. His face is too powerful for them to be able to look at him, although they were able to look at him before the Egel Hazov. So they've dropped him level tremendously. All they see is a black future before them. All their hopes are smashed. They've fallen. And they do tshuva and they're back to where they were. The Mishkan is there, God's presence is there, the magical fire comes onto the Mishkan, everything's working beautifully. Onto the Mizbeach, and everything's working beautifully. Says the Meshech Chochmah, there's now a terrible danger that the Jewish people are going to think you can get the Ribbono Shel Olam around your little finger. All you have to do is say, I'm sorry. That's all. You have to accept him again, and you have to believe and trust in him again, you give a bit more tzedakah, and you do a bit of tshuva, and 1, 2, 3, and it's all fixed up. They need to understand that sometimes there is a finality. The only time that we're confronted with finality are with two punishments: miso, death, and kores, a loss of olam haba, however we want to interpret kores, physical death and spiritual death. That's the only time that we're really confronted with the fact that sometimes the Ribbono Shel Olam does things which are final. Sometimes he does things from which there's no retracting. It's true that the gates of tshuva are usually open for us. It's true we can often reverse a decision of the Ribbono Shel Olam. But we need to know that sometimes we can't. If it was always possible to reverse his judgments, if it was always possible to do tshuva, if he never cured, what belief, what meaning would there be in mitzvahs and averas, in tshuva and not tshuva? What purpose would there be in it? I can always get it. I'll always say sorry one day, it'll be alright. From keepers coming, it'll be okay. It doesn't work like that. It's only when we know that there is a bottom line, and that there are times when the Ribbono Shel Olam says, Ad kan, up till here and no more, this is the last time. Only if we see that and understand that, does his tolerance become meaningful. You remember 2 weeks ago we talked about how an insult to everybody is an insult to nobody. Honoring everybody is honoring nobody. Loving everybody is loving nobody. Forgiving everybody is forgiving nobody. It's only when you know that the Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't always forgive that there's a way out. See here the difference, by the way, between what the Christian religion has built up, Lahavdil, and our Torah. With the Christian religion, there's always a way out. All you have to do is accept him. No matter how wicked you've been, no matter, you can even have been a Jew all your life. And at the end, all you have to do at the last moment of your life, you just have to accept him in love and all the rest of it, and you're okay. Your Olam Haba is guaranteed. The mere knowledge that there's always a way out is enough to make the entire religion meaningless. It's not real. You're playing with plastic chips. Because at the end, when you've lost all your money, you just go back to the cashier and ask for more. That's all. And you can't play roulette like that. And you can't do business like that. And you can't live like that. It's only because Nebuchadnezzar knows the story of Nadav Avihu. He knows that the Ribbono Shel Olam is not afraid to make people die, even his close ones, while they're busy serving him, from fire. And the 250 men of Korach, who were all great men, also died in the Mishkan, handling fire. Let's see what happens with Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah when they're thrown right into the middle of the furnace. Then let's see them. And he stands there with bated breath, almost 100% sure that they're going to be destroyed. And he watches, and they stand there, and the fire doesn't touch them. They walk out. That's Bikrovai Ekodesh, only because of Nodav Aviv, But I can reveal my kovod and they can remain, says the Ibn Ezra. After I've revealed my kovod, the yiru mimeni, the consequence of that will be yiru, fear. But what yiru? Yiras haremimus, it will be fear of my greatness, not fear of punishment. It's only because I've destroyed these people with fire that when Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah are saved from fire, the reaction of the Umas HaOlam, of the people of the world, will be, oh, how great is our Ribbono Shel Olam. But if I would not have done this now, I could never have revealed myself with kavod and known that the response to that would have been yira, would have been fear. Yiras HaRoimimus, the fear of God's greatness. That's a fear which is not irreconcilable with simcha. That's a fear which is not irreconcilable with joy. Because both of them are outward. I am now not fearing for myself. I'm now fearing Him. I'm now... All my emotions are directed outward. At the moment that my emotions are directed outward, even if they are emotions of awe, I can experience simcha at the same time. On the first level of yira, I can't. If I'm still on the level of yira, where I'm worried about the consequences of my actions in the fear sense, then it's not very easy to be relaxed enough at the same time to have simcha, to have joy, and to have pleasure. Yet we see that without that first yira, it's not possible to achieve the second yira. That without the fear of consequence, without the fear of punishment, and the hopeful reward, it's not possible even to graduate from that to the second level, because it just wouldn't mean anything. It would be completely meaningless to have all for somebody who's not capable of hurting you. That's not all. That's nothing. As we said 2 weeks ago, a person who can't hurt a flea is a flea. A god who can't hurt a flea is also a flea. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about a god who can and does. And then when he doesn't, he's not doing so imposes an obligation on you. You realize that he has restrained himself. You realize that he's held himself back because he wants something from you. Because he still expects something from you. That's why you're still alive. Not because he can't kill you. Not because he's afraid to kill you. Not because he's too soft to kill you. That's not why. He still wants something from you. He still wants performance. He still expects something from you. And that's why he's holding himself back, trying to encourage you to produce the goods, trying to encourage you to give him what he wants from you, to give him what you were created to do and what you were created to perform. In Hebrew, the comparative form that we use is very different to English, and I haven't had a chance to check it out in other classical languages. In English we say A is greater than B, or A is better than B. In Lashon HaKodesh we say that A is Tov Mi B. A is greater or better from B. Says Kohelis, the one that the Medrash quotes, Tov Shem Mi Shemen Tov. A good name is better from good oil. And it strikes me that there might be a deep meaning in the fact that that's how we phrase the comparative form. It's because of the oil that a good name is great. It is because of what happened with Nadab and Abihu. It's from them that it's better that Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah were able to achieve what they were able to achieve. It's because of the negative that we can appreciate the positive. It's because of the Gevurah that we can appreciate the Chesed. It's because of the strength and the power that we can appreciate the softness and the kindness. It's not two different things. The one flows from the other. It's because of the night that we can appreciate the day when we say day is lighter than night. What do we mean? Day is lighter from night. It's because we've had night that we can appreciate that the day is lighter. It's because we've had sadness that we can appreciate that now is more joyous than then, or that now is more sad than then. The one is greater, better, sadder, smaller, whatever comparative form you want to use, but the comparative has its roots in the first level. That's where it all comes from. If you take away the first level, there is no comparative. If you take away the first level, nothing is better than anything. Nothing is greater than anything. Nothing is less than anything. You need the two to be able to appreciate the one against the other. You need the Nadav HaAviv to be able to appreciate the Hananiah, Mishael and Azariah. Otherwise, that event would have gone by unnoticed and unrecorded. Walking into the fire, walking out of the fire, we would have taken it for granted. It's quite normal. You need to see that it's not so normal. You need to see that people have burnt themselves in that fire. Chazal say about the Torah itself, Tov, some of the Chaim lemaiminim bo, some of the Chaim lemasmiilim bo, some of the Moisa. The Torah itself is life potent to those who treat it with their right hand, who put all their energy and efforts into it, and it's some of the Moisa for those who don't. It's death for those who don't. Actually, it can cause one to deteriorate. It's not that it's one of these neutral part of the things, or that it's something which only makes you better. Because something which only makes you better is also a neutral part of a mess. And no such thing as something which only makes you better. If it's powerful, then it depends how you handle it. And if it's not powerful, then it can't do anything. Then it won't make you better, then it won't make you worse. It'll leave you entirely unaffected. But anything that can affect one positively can affect one negatively too. Anything that can affect one negatively can affect one positively too. The whole story of the movement of the Aron, of the Ark of Hashem, in the 6th chapter of Shmuel Beis, contains this element. You know the famous story that David decided to move the Aron, and he put it on a cart. It was pulled by cattle, and as they were moving up towards Yerushalayim, the cattle jerked and the Ark shook, and the wagon shook, and the Ark tilted and was about to fall. And Uzzah was standing nearby, and he put out his hand and held the ark to stop it falling. Vayichar af Hashem beUzzah, and Hashem got angry with Uzzah. Vayakeyu shom ha'elukim al Hashem, and there the Ribbono Shel Olam smote him because of his mistake. Vayom Hashem im Aron ha'elukim, and he died there with the arrow next to the arrow. We won't go into now. We did that already in the Lady Shir as to why he died, what he did wrong, and so on. The Medrash asks, in the next pasuk, David says, "Vayichar leDavid al asher porat Hashem peretz beUzzah." David got angry that Hashem broke out against Uzzah. Who did he get angry with? Angry with Hashem, Chas v'Shalom. He knows the Ribbono Shel Olam is Elokei Mishpat, that Elokei is a God of justice and will do justice. So who is he angry with? Angry with Uzzah? Uzzah's mistake was so minute that I don't know if there's a human being in the world that could have withstood that mistake. You see the Aron falling and you're not going to put out your hand to stop it. David is worried, says the Medrash, about his mistake. He's angry at himself. Because it says in the Medrash that Hashem says to David, criticizing one of his psukim in Tehillim, one of his verses in Tehillim, where David HaMelech says, Zmirois hoyu li chukecha, your statutes were to me like song. Says the Ribbono Shel Olam to him, David, how can you call my statutes, which are ka'esh oichlo, which are like consuming fire, how can you call that song, entertainment? Is that what Torah is to you? And of course David meant it on very deep levels, and of course it is emes, because it wasn't taken out of Tanakh. It's still there, it's still in Tanakh. So although the Ribbono Shel Olam was critical of it, he was critical in the slightest sense that it might convey a wrong meaning, or that deep down it displays a certain misunderstanding on David's great levels of understanding, not something that we're capable of achieving in our own intellects. We don't know what it really means. But one thing we do see, that as true as the statement is, there's a point of criticism in it. Zmiro sayuni chukecho. Is Torah just something to sing and dance about? If Torah was just something to sing and dance about, it would lose all its meaning. It would be like playing roulette with plastic money. Zmiro sayuni chukecho, says the Ribbono Shel Olam, for that, you're going to make a mistake which every little cheder child knows. You're going to put that ark on a wagon instead of having it carried by hand. Every child who's learned Chumash, you'll ask him, how was the Aron carried? He'll tell you it was carried by the Levim by hand. There was a special pole that was inserted in loops on the sides of the Aron so that they could be carried on the shoulders of the Levim. You're going to slip up, and then you'll see what songs this is, because somebody's going to die because of your mistake. Then you'll understand. And David immediately realizes that this is the consequence of a man on his high level, a slightly wrong angle of looking at the chukim, at the mitzvahs of the Ribbono Shel Olam. These are not zmiras, this is fire. It's true that fire can warm you when you're cold. It's true that you can sit around a bonfire and like Bahamut in the night, and you can sing and you can dance. But what about when you jump into the fire or come too close?
That same fire which you're seeing is also a sheikhlo. It's a consuming, devastating fire. And then it becomes real.
And David gets such a shock with Vayiro David is Hashem by Yomahu. And David feared God that day. And what does it mean that God, David feared God that day, but he hadn't feared God before Chas V'Shalom? That his Yiro became enormous and it became Yiras HaInesh. Up till then, David HaMelech was operating on much higher levels. David HaMelech was operating on Yiras HaRoimimus, the fear of God's greatness. He was operating on Ahavas Hashem. But God's criticism of him was that at the foundation there was something missing. There wasn't enough Yiras HaInesh. There wasn't enough realization of the terrible consequences there can be of one false slip on his level, just the tiniest slipper, and a man can die. And now he's learned that. So much so that he didn't want to take the ark back home, and he sent it off to Oved Edom Hagiti. Now he's full of fear. And it's only later on, when he hears that Oved Edom Hagiti has had tremendous bracha, has had tremendous blessing from the Ribbono Shel Olam because of the presence of the ark there, that he again feels comfortable about approaching the ark, approaching the Oren, and bringing it up to Yerushalayim. And this time he does it again, besimcha, with great rejoicing. So much rejoicing, so much dancing and seeing and rejoicing, that Michal, his wife, the princess, the daughter of the previous king Shaul, and we've learned previously how meticulous Shaul was about his dress, and how meticulous Shaul was about his bearing and his dignity. And Michal, his daughter, looks out at the window and she sees the new king, her husband, dancing around. And already his sleeves were already a centimeter off from his ankles, disgusting, from his wrists. And his tunic was already a couple of centimeters above his ankle, and you could see his feet, disgusting. Is that how a king behaves? And she gives him musr for it, she tells him off. And David gets angry at her. And he says, Lifnei Hashem asher bochar bi me'avicha, before that same God who chose me over your father, V'sichakti lifnei Hashem, I was rejoicing before the Ribbono Shel Olam. Which is a very similar answer to the answer given in the Gemara immediately after the little piece of Gemara with which we opened. Abaya have Yosef kamei de Rabbo. Abaya was sitting before Rabbo. Chazye, he saw him, davekor badach tuba, he saw Rav was being too jovial. Abaya took exception. Abaya was a Talmud, and he felt that his Rebbe Rabbo was cracking too many jokes in the shiur already. One or two is enough, but it was going too far. So he said to him, Omar, he said, v'gilu bir'odoksiv. It's all very well rejoicing, but it says rejoice in trembling, says Abaya to his Rebbe Rabbo. Answers Rabbi Omale, Ano tefillin manchana. What are you talking about? I've got my tefillin on. Says Rashi, Behem edus shenem sheles koini umesharto oloi. And they bear evidence that the rulership, the government of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and my dedication to him is on my consciousness. I would never wear tefillin for one moment if I wasn't sure that I was totally committed to serving the Ribbono Shel Olam at every moment of that time. Wouldn't have tefillin on it that night. Can't you see I'm wearing tefillin, so you know what's going on? The same kind of answers David HaMelech gives. Yes, I'm rejoicing. Yes, I'm telling a joke or two. But I'm standing before the Ribbono Shel Olam when I do that. And I'm in full consciousness and seriousness. And this isn't just a bit of lightheadedness that's come over me. This is conscious, willing. I know exactly what I'm doing with, and I'm doing it right in the presence of the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's the combination of simcha, of Gila with Ra'odah. The ability to combine Gila and Ra'odah. That David HaMelech himself had to suffer the terrible tragedy of the loss of Uzzah before he was able to achieve that level properly. Before he was really able to take the Yiras HaRoimimus, the awareness of the Ribbono Shel Olam's greatness, tempered by Yiras HaInesh, by that fear of consequences which always lies at the foundation and at the very bottom of everything that we do, and combine it with Gimel Lefonov, combine it with Simcha and with rejoicing, and there you have the perfect balance of emotion which the Torah requires. A deep joy combined with deep and clear consciousness of before whom we stand, and at the bottom of that consciousness always aware that one false step and chas v'shalom there can be death, or there can be loss, or there can be loss of an olam haba. And with that, the joy is not meaningless. With that, the joy is not entertainment. With that, we experience the kind of joy that these explorers feel in their little way when they conquer the top of Everest, when they take a trip to the moon and they walk on the moon, when they write a great work of literature, produce a great work of philosophy. That kind of feeling we have in much greater proportions, in much greater levels, and in much greater depth when we're able to achieve that. The understanding that one false step and we're dead, and yet being able to forget about that a little bit, and to be able to be involved in something which is real because one false step and we're dead. If it weren't for that, it wouldn't be real. But apart from that, it has all the romance, it has all the depth, it has all the beauty of something which isn't real, of something which is quite beyond reality. And the combination of the reality of life with the unreality of Torah, in a sense, with this glorious living of Torah, enables the human being to achieve that level which David HaMelech achieved. V'sichakti lifnei Hashem, I'm able to rejoice before the Ribbono Shel Olam, not only at odd occasions in one's life, but throughout one's life, whether chas v'shalom one is confronted with tragedy, or whether one is experiencing simchas, to be able to feel at the same time that feeling of joy of standing before the Ribbono Shel Olam, tempered by the knowledge that life is for real, and that everything that one does has to be accounted for.